With Rising Sun, your latest book, did you have something against the Japanese?
No, not at all. I like the Japanese.
Personally, you like the Japanese?
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually one of the interesting things about this has been to hear responses back from other people, and a number of people have said to me, in effect, how could you attack so strongly? And I think, in a way, I feel able to criticize because I don't have any... I like Japan. I mean, I'm very attracted to it and drawn to many aspects of that. So from my point of view, I'm merely criticizing what I think ought to be criticized, and I don't have another agenda. It's not racist. It's not anything else.
Okay. So just a little bit here.
Well, I imagine, since I heard your broadcast last night on the Larry King Show, and I imagine much of your interviews will focus around the political and economic aspects of the book, and of course that's very important to the book. In fact, something unusual for a novel is that you actually have a postscript and a bibliography that that really in fiction that's just not really heard of, is it?
Yeah, I've done it before.
In Jurassic Park, I believe you did.
Yeah, and I did it in The Terminal Man, and I'm not sure whether I did it in another book. But it's certainly an unusual thing to do.
It's unusual because it makes people think the book is less fiction than it is nonfiction. That's what nonfiction writers do. They put footnotes and they put bibliographies and this sort of thing.
Well, I have always felt very uneasy about the distinction between fiction and nonfiction. In the sense that it seems to me that a lot of nonfiction, or what passes for nonfiction, is contrived. And a lot of fiction is in many ways more real than not. At one point I wanted to write a history book, and I started reading the history of the American Revolution in some breadth, and I was continuously shocked at the speculations that historians make, which were, as a novelist, I would never dare to make. I mean, I thought, there's no basis for these ideas. Why are they saying these things? So I guess the rules of the game are slightly different, but they overlap.
Well, it is said that that nonfiction tells you the way what happened. Nonfiction tells you what happened, but fiction tells you what people really think and what really happened. I mean, in nonfiction is almost like a chronology of events, but with fiction you can get into characters and get into thoughts and lives in a way that you can't do with nonfiction.
I think that's right. And I think there's some advantage to that.
Well, you could have written a nonfiction book called Rising Sun, and it may have been read by some people, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also get a message across in a fictionalized way that says much the same thing, only it will carry an audience in a way that a nonfiction book often cannot do. Would you agree to that?
Yes, absolutely. And certainly the subject area in this case, which is economic relations between the United States and Japan, is not something that's seems to be of tremendous immediate interest to the American population, although lately that seems to have changed.
Yeah, I saw a photograph, I believe it was at a car dealership in California, and people could go up to this, it was a Toyota, I believe, Toyota, and people, I think they made a donation, they could slam the Japanese-built car with a sledgehammer. Which kind of sounds like, it sounds like kind of a childish thing to do. It doesn't really address the problem of Japanese-American relations, does it?
No, it doesn't. It's the kind of symbolic event that's, I think, in the end, very empty. You know, in a way, for me, the symbology of Bush's most recent trip to Japan was his vomiting on the Prime Minister's trouser. I mean, I had that kind of sense of that was about all that was really accomplished in that trip. And one of the things that I feel very strongly about and try to convey in the book is that if the United States is to have a better relationship from our standpoint with Japan, we're really going to have to change our attitudes. I mean, it's pointless, as in a marriage, you know, to ask the other person to change. If you want to change, you better change yourself. and see the relationship change on that basis.
Well, let's go back to the beginning, and let me ask you how Rising Sun came about and why you have decided in this form to address this problem, which has been growing for some time.
The my own interests must go back to the late 80s. I have notes for a book in 87, 88, and I'm not exactly sure now why what the initial provocation was. I think I became disturbed about the sale of American high-tech companies to Japan. I mean, we started in the late 80s. We began to sell one American company every 10 days or so, and we've done that for the last 5 years. And to look at a list of a couple of hundred American companies that have been sold is a very disturbing thing. You know, it really raises questions of how long we can continue to sell our technological future to our chief competitor and expect to have anything left in terms of our own future.
You say a lot about American society as well in this book. I kept looking for the passage, but I couldn't find it. But somewhere in the book you write that the Japanese consider us barbarians. And look at our crime rate. No civilized country on earth has the kind of crime rate that the American people have. You said something to that effect. I can't remember exactly where it is, but it really stuck out. Yeah. Because there are a lot of things wrong with our society, and I think perhaps you pinpointed it very well in Rising Sun. Maybe you could elaborate on that.
Well, I think there's absolutely no question that that we have made decisions in our society that no other industrial state has made. We have, for some reason, elected to tolerate the highest crime rate in the world. You know, last year we had 25,000 murders in this country. The rate is, I don't know, 20 times higher than England, 100 times higher than Japan. I mean, the difference is so striking that when you're in a Japanese city, it takes a little while for you to realize that you don't always have to be looking over your shoulder at night, that you can go anywhere that you want to go, that you can be alone or in a group and you're safe in any case. We are so accustomed to maintaining a constant level of tension and alertness and fear that we're going to be assaulted, that we're going to be shot, that we're going to be mugged, raped. And that's starting to become a part of the fabric of our society. It's crazy when you think about it. And, you know, when you start to talk about what there is about America that's different, the thing that immediately leaps out is gun control. Ours is the only nation that I'm aware of that has elected to say there are no limitations on ownership of guns. Every other nation makes another decision and in return gets safe citizenry, gets safe streets. We are the only nation left now that has no health care policy. We are the only major industrial nation without an industrial policy. Look at Japan, look at Germany. Those countries have decided on the proper way for industry and government to work together. As the United States once did, have a clear idea about how government and the defense industry would work together for the defense of America. And there was no foolishness about that in the United States. I mean, people wanted a strong defense. They were willing to pay for it. They didn't care what administration was in power. The belief in a strong American defense cut across party lines, cut across presidential positions. That's what we wanted, and that's what we continuously had. And that sort of across-the-board national policy is how the Japanese feel about their own industry and their own exports. So it isn't really surprising that when you see a country in which the people, the industries, and the government are in agreement about what ought to happen, when a nation like that is in economic competition with a nation like the United States, which is in disarray, which has no agreement about how it ought to proceed, which has totally open markets, which has no assistance from government or business, often interference, that the organized country just wipes us out. And that's what's happened.
Back to the crime problem we have in this country. Are you saying that the gun control is the key to it?
I don't know what the key to it is. You know, Don, when you compare any two countries, you know, whether you're talking about crime, whether you're talking about education, whether you're talking about drugs, you can see differences, and you can between how one country does and how another country does it, and you can ask what are the differences related to that. There's certainly a strong element in this country that says that gun control and crime are not related. But as far as I know, we're the only country without gun control, strict gun control. And we have the highest murder rate. So if they're not related, it seems to me the burden of proof to demonstrate the lack of relation, you know, I mean, is on the people who feel it's necessary that everyone should have a gun.
Well, there's another problem, too. It's our horrendous rate of drug addiction. And these are often the people who have come into possession of guns, because these junkies are absolutely desperate for fixes. And it's not... doesn't matter to them who they kill, as long as they get the high from the drugs, and so they obviously can't earn the money for drugs, so they have to take it.
Right. I don't know the statistics offhand, but it seems to me that if you place the drug related murders at the highest percentage that you could, I mean, I'm just sort of guessing at statistics I don't remember, you would still have, that would be about half the murders. So you'd still, I think, lead the world with non-drug-related murders.
And another phenomenon, too, most of these mass killings have happened within the last 10 years. When you think about it, every time there's a mass killing, the New York Times runs a list of mass killings in recent memory, and you'll see that they have increased over the years in numbers. It's frightening. I mean, the fact that someone gets an assault weapon and mows down 10, 12, 14 mm-hmm. people at one time. It's frightening. It's not. It's the kind of thing that might happen in a war.
Yeah. There's some way, I don't know how to talk about this except in very vague terms, but one of the things that struck me most about my last trip to Japan was that Japanese school children cross the street without a crossing guard. What they do is, at each side of the street, there's a little metal cup attached to a stand or to a telephone pole. And inside the cup are flags, yellow flags on little sticks. And what the children do is, as they come to school in the morning, they each take a flag and wave the flag, and they cross the street, and the cars all stop. And when they get to the other side of the street, they put the flags in the other cup so that they'll be ready when they come home going the other way. No one steals the flags. No one defaces the cup. No one trashes it or tears it or messes it up. It's perfectly safe. I mean, the society has a coherence and an agreement. And I think in some way that we're not really acknowledging the crime rate is a function of social controls that are instilled in all of us as a sort of group agreement. And that there are, of course, in every society, people who break out or who become crazy or who, for one or another reason, break free from the social order. But there is a social order in most places, and America seems to have lost the sense that even ought to be. You know, you can watch Americans step over a homeless person in the street as if that person isn't in the same environment, as if they are not also a part of this country, as if that we don't all share something together. And the Japanese understand very clear that they have a country and they share something together. Americans used to, I think, even though we are a melting pot, they used to have some kind of coherent feeling, some sense of community and some sense of national identity that seems to have dissipated.
You went to Japan how many times?
I've been there many times, but for extended periods, only twice. I was meant to go back actually this past November to attend a conference in Kyoto, and I broke my arm at the Christo umbrellas in California, and I was a casualty of the Christo umbrellas.
A survivor.
And couldn't go. I was a survivor. Yes, exactly.
Well, what was it like? I've never been to Japan. I've talked to some people who have enjoyed it and other people who didn't like the Japanese at all. But tell me about your experience. What was it like for you? What has it been like for you?
I like it very much. I think one's experience is in part a function of small things. For example, I have a much easier time there than my wife because I like the food. I'm perfectly happy to eat raw fish all the time, and she has a lot of trouble with that. And so on a sort of daily, ongoing basis, I have an easier time, even though, because I'm so tall, I'm continuously the subject of interest in Japan. I mean, I clearly don't fit in a physical sense. But in,
how do they treat you?
Well, the ordinary reaction is to giggle. It produces laughter. I mean, it's a sort of nervous or uncomfortable feeling, particularly with women. They laugh. And there are times when that laughter doesn't mean to them what it means to a Western person, but it's, there are times when I really can't help having a Western reaction to seeing a couple of dozen people in a department store laughing at me.
But they are unfailingly
they're
polite, as you
yes,
indicated.
They don't mean, but I still have my own kind of reaction to it. But ordinarily, that I don't have that sort of experience. And in some ways, I feel more comfortable in Japan, I guess. I mean, I like the way that everyone really takes pride in their job and that everyone really does it as well as they can do. And it's clean, that it's safe, that in a funny way you have more personal freedom because of that.
In Rising Sun, the old detective, I believe his name is Connor.
Yes.
He educates the younger detective, Smith, I believe, Peter
right.
Smith, as to how the Japanese are socialized and how their body movements convey certain messages. Maybe you can elaborate on that for me.
Well, I think there's a feature of something that's most difficult for Americans to comprehend because it's so alien to us. Because we assume that we are whatever we are, white, black, Hispanic, that we are a segment of the society. And that there are other segments that are different from us. The Japanese do not have that conception of the nation. They imagine that everyone shares certain kinds of perceptions and beliefs, and as a result of that, they are able to communicate heavily in nonverbal ways. And it's more. I guess the analogy for us would be the kind of communication that it can occur in a family between a father and a son or a mother and a child, the kind of unspoken understanding of what's going on, what the other person is feeling. Even Japanese who don't know each other well have some sense of that between them in a way that Americans don't. Americans always want things spelled out. You know, Americans always want to know what the deal is and what do you mean by that. And Americans have a wish for a certain explicitness that the Japanese find mystifying and unnecessary.
Now, at the heart of Rising Sun is an old-fashioned murder mystery. And while, of course, it's assumed that the Japanese or a Japanese has committed the murder, we won't give away how it ends because there is a twist. But one of the interesting things about it is the technology involved, because part of solving the crime is based on analyzing a security videotape. It's interesting that you note that the Japanese are actually 3 years ahead of us technologically, electronically. Is that really correct?
Well, certainly in some of these areas they're now moving well ahead. And it actually I think it was the Defense Department, which a year or so ago identified 10 or 12 significant technologies for the 90s and into the 21st century, and made an assessment of which of these technologies America was doing well in comparison to Japan, where we were slipping and where we were leading. We were, in fact, moving ahead in only one. We were holding our own in three or four, and we were slipping in all the rest. So the Japanese, which in American fantasy have been copycats, people who've taken things that were invented here and many things that they are famous for, like the fax machine and the VCR and the digital watch, were all invented here. The Japanese are moving ahead, and they are developing strategies for innovation. And certainly in areas such as video technology, they are the world leaders.
Sometimes we shoot ourselves in the foot. Look at the digital audio tape machines, the DAT machines, mm-hmm. supposed to be clearly superior to anything we have now, including the CDs. We have them, just barely, but because of competition or because of something, these machines have been kept artificially high in terms of price and are not universally acceptable. Is that the result of our doing something wrong ourselves? I mean, what's going on here? I'm sure the Japanese are using them to great advantage.
I wasn't aware that there are any American manufacturers of DAT machines. Is that true?
No, I don't believe there are.
Yeah,
but we're importing these machines, but still are not using them to the degree we probably should.
Mm-hmm. The understanding that I have about that is that there are about to be competing formats, and it's not clear right now that DAT cassette technology as it presently exists is the one that's going to emerge as the final one. Philips has a competing technology. Sony has one. And I'm not sure what exactly is going to happen. But that's the sense that I have about what the price structure of those machines are. It's a little bit undecided still.
Tell me a little bit about the research that you did with regard to Rising Sun, because you have an awful lot of information about Japanese customs and habits and how they do business.
I think that I'm not easily able to answer that question, because when I start to work on a book and work in an area, I am aware of reading and clipping and making notes over a period of years. And so that at the time I come to write, I don't have much sense of doing any research at all, and I'm just going to write it. And then inevitably there arises the question of how I know something. I mean, for one thing, the lawyers always go over it and say, well, how do you know this, and can you demonstrate that? And often I have to go back as if I hadn't written the book. You know, go to the library and look it up and say, well, how do I know this? You know, it's a funny problem.
Did you have some Japanese friends who analyzed the customs in the book for you?
I certainly had some expert readers who went over it, and one Japanese translator who brought the language into line. But yeah, a number of people who have what I would consider expert knowledge checked the manuscript for me at various points and corrected me when they felt I was going astray.
Now, the publisher Knopf made a rather unusual publishing decision about the book. Can you tell me about that?
I'm talking about the decision to advance the publication.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know what. I finished the book in August of last year, August of 91, and it was scheduled for the end of February, and then for March, and then it came out in early February. So I'm not really sure what the factors were in why it moved around. I've never.
Yes, it didn't. You turned in the manuscript in August of last year, so what the publisher decided to do in terms of its publishing timetable really didn't have much impact on you, except in terms of publicizing the book. Is that correct?
Right. What I actually feel is that it's enough work for me to just write the books, and I feel that I have a really good publisher, and they must know more about publishing books than I do, and so I just take their recommendation. They said it ought to be published at this time, and I said, fine. And then they said, it ought to be published earlier, and I said, fine.
It's such an odd, staggered timetable with regard to publishing. By the time you finish your book, months, years sometimes go by before it gets into print. What is this like for an author? Do you ever lose kind of feeling of contact with the book because of this gap in having such a close relationship with the book?
I don't know what other writers feel, but the sense that I have always is, first of all, by the time I finished a book, I'm usually very thoroughly sick of the subject and never want to think about it again or talk about it again. So I suppose if I were to finish the book and then immediately do publicity, I would be quite cranky. On the other hand, several months later, in this case it's what, 6 or 7 months later, there is a certain feeling of distance, you know, as if that's an old marriage, you know, that we're now reviving and talking about. And so what I get back in a new feeling of interest, because the time has gone by, I also have a sort of distant sense of that. Yeah.
What's it like picking up one of your older books, like The Andromeda Strain or one of those, and looking at it? You see your name mm-hmm. on the dust jacket and everything, but do you really feel it's yours with all the time involved going by?
I don't. It's funny. It's odd you mention that. For about 10 years, the books seem to be something that is recognizably mine, but further back, I look at them and I sometimes literally think, who wrote this? You know, it has no sense of relating to me at all. I mean, I don't. First of all, I don't really remember much about the writing, the activity of the writing. Whereas a more recent book, I can turn pages and I can come to some sections and I remember this was a hard thing and I had to do this many times, or something happened to my daughter at the time I was working on this and I was interrupted. I have all these memories that are related to parts of the text. But as time goes by, that fades, and eventually I don't have any sense of association to the text. It is literally as if someone else wrote it.
Kind of like life itself, which is why we keep photographs.
Yeah.
You know, you remember that happy day on the beach, or mm-hmm. that terrific birthday party for your daughter, or the great meal that you whipped up one night for a bunch of people and you had so much fun.
Right.
But they're just little glimpses into the past, as though they were lived by someone else.
Yes.
It's really eerie, isn't it? Well, I know you have another appointment, and I'm sorry we had to be kind of rushed. Always like to talk to you. It's certainly a pleasure. Rising Sun is a terrific thriller with a socioeconomic message. I hope it catches on, and I'm sure it will. I'm be anxious to see it in the movies, because I heard you last night saying that this is going to be the case, so I'll be looking forward to that. Michael Crichton, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Don.